I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. We come your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on Co-op. That's KOOP.org in Austin, Texas, 91.7 FM. We're rebroadcast on several other community radio stations around the country. Our podcasts are put up at the Internet Archive and at other places. And so we get out there, and we want to thank everybody for listening. We're produced in conjunction with... We're produced in the studios of Co-op in conjunction with the New Journalism Project and the Rag Blog. So if you want to find us, our page is go to theragblog.com/ragradio. And you can find every show we've ever done there. And you can listen to the podcast. So too cool. All right. I want to tell everybody that I want to thank Tracy Schultz, of course, for being here. My cohort and producer and my engineer.
Yeah.
What are you anyway?
A little bit of everything. Yeah. Well, always happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, we're thrilled to have you, of course, as always. It's a kind of a nice day.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
Austin, Texas.
Yeah, a little cloud cover, but we'll take it. It's a little cooler.
And Nirvana in the hills here, becoming less Nirvana every day as it keeps expanding. 150 people a day moving to Austin, Texas. Go away! All right. My guest today, I'm led to understand, is the love child of Lenny Bruce and Saul Alinsky. Larry Bogat, L.M. Bogat's artful activism, this is according to Truthout, blends the strategies of civil disobedience with heaping doses of Harpo Marx. As a professor and tactical performer, Bogad says he is committed to speaking mirth to power. Larry Bogat is an author, performer, educator, and the founding director of the Center for Tactical Performance. He is professor of political performance at the University of California at Davis, where he mentors graduate students and teaches classes such as satire, irony, and protest, tactical performance, and oppositional performance in social movements. He was co-founder of the clandestine insurgent rebel clown army, is the author of Electoral Guerrilla Theater, Radical Ridicule in Social Movements, which tells the stories of performance artists around the world who run for public office as a radical prank, and Tactical Performance, the Theory and Practice of Serious Play, which analyzes and critiques the use of guerrilla theater, activist art, and pranks for human and civil rights, and for social justice, labor, and environmental campaigns. Whew! What a task you've taken upon yourself. Welcome to Rag Radio, Larry.
Thanks so much, Thorne. I really appreciate being on the show.
Okay, it's cool. And I love the work you're doing. And I want you to tell us, there's so much we can talk about. As we communicated before the show, I mean, we could be doing three shows because there's so much to talk about. And you have a fascinating history. You have, I love your theories, and I love the way you put them into practice. So,
thank you so much, man.
So we'll talk about all kinds of things, but we have to start somewhere. So that's what I've learned over time. You got to start somewhere. So, tell us about tactical performance and your theory.
Sure. I mean, for me, tactical performance, it sounds like a big, highfalutin phrase, but all I mean by that is for activists to use some of the skills and ideas from the theater in planning social movement campaigns. Like, what can the theater teach us in terms of making activism both more fun for the people doing it, but also more creative and more compelling or convincing for people that are not already on our side? So how do we use costumes or comedy or satire or very serious tragedic elements, you know, from very serious theater, to make people sort of look at the issues from a new light and surprise them a little bit in public space and have them go, you know, I never thought of about it that way. A way to reach out to people across some boundaries and not just do the same old form of protest.
Okay, you not only teach students, but you actually have a rich history of performance art yourself and of organizing activities. I want to talk about some of the specific things you've done in a little bit, but first of all, tell me What is the, give me the parallels between the civil rights sit-ins in the 60s and the antics of the clown army?
That's a really good question, Thorne, because these two things seem nothing alike, and in many ways there aren't. You know, you've got the very dignified, serious, and high-stakes actions of the civil rights movement, you know, in the 50s and 60s. And then you've got something I was part of starting in 2003, this kind of absurd protest group called the Clown Army, which was, you know, we were ridiculous. We fused civil disobedience with clowning in order to create a sense of fun, fearlessness, but also playfulness and gentleness in protest, right? So what does that silliness have to do with the civil rights movement? And the underlying things are, ideas are like, we learn from our ancestors. Even if what we're doing looks different, there's some underlying principles. So when civil rights activists back in the day did their actions, they thought in terms of drama. And very, very specifically using these terms, like, we're going to do a sociodrama today, you know, in the racist, segregated lunch counters.
Right.
We're going to go and sit in at great risk to ourselves. We're going to get attacked and beaten by the crowd who are mad that we're doing it because they want to support that segregation. And then the police are going to come and arrest us, not them, right? But so they, as they did that kind of very dangerous and very compelling action, they did call it sociodrama. And they thought in terms of dramatics. What's it going to look like? How are we going to stage this protest? You know, what are we going to wear? How are we going to comport ourselves? What are we going to say? In what tone? And if you think I'm exaggerating, they really did rehearse backstage. It's one of the lesser-known aspects of the whole history, is in churches or community centers or people's homes, they practiced with other people yelling at them and slapping them and blowing smoke in their face so they would be prepared for how it was really going to go down when they actually did it. Because it was very important for them. They signed a discipline statement of what they would do. If you were going to do this action, you had to agree to wear your Sunday best, you know, speak softly, maintain your dignity, don't laugh or curse or strike back. Like, it was such a specific script you had to sign your name to. And so they were prepared when they went into this dangerous situation. They knew that they had created a scene where they would be seen as the good guys in the play. And the racist mob that attacked them would come across as this, you know, really demented crowd of antagonists, both because of what was happening and the way they had agreed to comport and perform their roles. And so when the police come at the end, it's like scene one, they come and sit down. They're very dignified, they're very respectful, and everyone refuses them service. Okay. Scene two, the mob gradually accumulates in most of these places and starts to attack them physically and yell at them and all this sort of thing. Scene three is the police show up and, to anyone's sensibility, arrest the wrong people. It's the twist ending of this very cruel play that they've knowingly set up, where the police show up and arrest the victims, not the attackers. Now, anyone in Tennessee at the time or Alabama would know that that was going to happen. But people in France or Britain or even Minnesota were surprised by that ending when they saw it on TV or read about it in the papers because they hadn't been paying attention. So this kind of intervention with their predictable opponents playing the bad guys in a very heightened, dramatic sense, they called this creative suffering. That was their term, you know. They said, we're going to enact we're suffering anyway under this system. Let's be creative about it. And with creative suffering and sociodrama, we'll make this dramatic intervention. So people in other parts of the country and other parts of the world started to pay attention and to support their cause. So anyway, I just wanted to trace that out to give a sense of their sense of the dramatic. In fact, Dr. King was interviewed on Meet the Press in 1960. It's one of my favorite quotes in my book. The interviewer is like, how come you're doing all of these sit-ins and disruptive things that are so troubling and the people get violent against your people? And why are you doing that? Why don't you just stick to more, you know, relaxed forms of protest? And Dr. King just very patiently explained to him. He said, yeah, look, a lot of people are not aware of what's happening in the South, and they're not paying attention, and sometimes you have to dramatize the issue. And when he used that term dramatize, it just reflects how important to them the use of dramatic thinking was for getting people who didn't work. It's about getting people who aren't already on your side interested, at least, and maybe softening the opposition. There may be people who are just a little bit against you and they're not thinking about it. Sometimes you can reach out to those folks with this kind of action, and at least they'll turn neutral. They may not support you, but they'll stop opposing you. Okay, so that's that really important example. Now, when you get to ridiculous things like the Clown Army, we don't have any pretense to be as important or as dignified or important for history as those folks. all I'm saying is we have learned lessons from them about how to use drama and how to think in terms of imagery and dramatic tension. Now, the approach of the Clown Army was also creative nonviolence. You know, we would kiss the riot shields of the policemen as they were pushing people down the street. The clowns don't fight back. They don't run away either. They start to play games with the police, even if the police aren't really playing. You know, it would be a way of relating to them, at pretending that they're our friends and disarming them, not literally, but conceptually. And that's the kind of thing that the Clown Army would do, to take the violence down a notch, take the aggravation and the tension down. And then by being an army of clowns who genuinely have trained in both civil disobedience and clowning, we did get a lot of media attention because it was so strange and surprising in this weird way. So we would get an opportunity to then state our serious political thing into the press where we might have been ignored otherwise.
You had some wonderful, there's some wonderful images that you, I think, are on your site or that I've seen, which that I think got wide distribution. And one was of a cop through his riot helmet, through his riot, whatever, shield,
yeah,
and everything, laughing as they were confronting him. And the other one was the picture of the actual shield, not the face covering, with a big lipstick kiss on it.
Right.
Both of those, I think, like, got wide distribution.
That's right. Like, this was from a confrontation in Scotland when we were protesting the policies of the G8. It's now the G20, but at the time it was the G8. And we were,
these things just grow, don't they? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, exactly. They sure do. And you know, we had specific critiques about how they were handling the issue of debt in underdeveloped countries and environmental policies and things like that. But we first wanted to, like, not let things get distracted into this whole thing about the fighting with the police and property damage and all these things that distract people from the serious policy critiques we have. So as absurd as the clown thing was, when you're kissing the riot shields and you're basically confronting that demonization of protesters, oh, they're all just angry and dangerous people, you know, and the press would sometimes ramp it up like that in this kind of unfair stereotype, where the clowns were partly designed specifically to disarm that stereotype. And, you know, say what you will, but when you've got the clown kissing the riot shield and the police are calming down or laughing or backing off, actually, at the end of that particular conversation, the police just left because after a while they realized, okay, these guys are clowns, let's just leave them alone. And when that kind of thing happens, and it's on YouTube or it's in the media, it's on the front page of some papers, what I like to think of it as an irresistible image, an image that even your opponents will reproduce just because it's such a compelling image. And we don't always get that right, and there's a little bit of luck involved. But with the Clown Army, we had the most right-wing tabloids in Britain, like the Murdoch papers, you know, who had been saying what terrible people the protesters were. They were showing the image of the clowns with the kissing and everything.
They were showing the image. There was one of them that you had of the front page that showed the images of the clowns, but then it had a real negative headline. But you pointed out,
right,
it's probably that photo that's going to have more impact.
Well, you make a really good point. The text is totally against the protesters, but the photo confuses the issue. Like, they've got the photo next to this headline. The photo doesn't match the headline, but they just can't resist the image. They got to put it in there. And I try to get into a lot of examples in the book of that kind of thing. We don't always get it right, and it doesn't always work, you know. And you have to adjust what you're doing to the cultural terrain of the country or the state that you're working in. You know, you can't just do the same thing all the time. So, for example, when we had a clown army in New York, well, the New York police are a little more paramilitary, a little more aggressive. We didn't do the same kind of stuff that we did in Scotland. We changed it up. You got to change your routines, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
The book that we're referring to is Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play. And my guest is Larry Bogad. Tell us, when you were talking about the sit-ins and the fact that the wrong people were arrested, you tell a wonderful, I guess we'd call it the parable of the couple in the theater.
Oh, wait, now, which
where the people start getting assaulted?
Oh, yes, exactly.
Maybe they weren't in a theater. I don't know.
No, totally, exactly. No, I get it, yeah. Like, what I was trying to think about when I was writing about this the way the sit-ins were deliberately devised so strategically. You know, imagine if you're in the theater and you're watching a show and here's someone sitting down calmly and someone comes up from above and behind them, standing above them, and starts hitting them. very basic biomechanics, very basic way that we stage things in the theater to put sympathy on one person and the audience to not have sympathy for the other. Well, when we all know, it doesn't even matter what the play is, when someone attacks somebody else from above and behind in the most cowardly fashion, we all know we can empathize with what that would feel like. And if, apart from the 1% of people who are sadists, for real, everyone else is going to feel more sympathy for the person who's sitting down and being attacked, right? From, again, above and behind. Well, this is what was happening in the lunch counter sit-ins. The folks had trained and rehearsed, and just that, even if you don't know what the issues are with the racism and the legal inequality and all that, the terrible oppression, you're seeing someone sitting down and somebody else, actually a bunch of people, attacking them from above and behind. And immediately, just like in the theater, except this is the theater of real life, people in Norway, you know, people in India who are seeing these images will sympathize with the people who are being attacked in that sense.
Right.
So it was really worked out both on a very personal level of just basic human connection and then the big macro political issues too, because, you know, then on the big macro scale, you know, it worked because this was happening during the Cold War, right? And the United States was calling itself the leader of the free world, and we were against the Soviets because they were very oppressive, right, which is true, and they were very horrible to their own citizens. But then this imagery is disrupting that narrative, isn't it? Because the police are coming in and arresting the wrong people at the end of the skit.
Yeah, well, I'd love, yeah, I mean, that's, you had to, you had to, it was so stark because you had these people, they were harassed and the harassment grew, this couple, and then they were being hit and then they were thrown to the ground and they were kicked, and then the cops come in and arrest the people who are on the ground. And
that's right.
We've seen that happen so often in this day and time.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, we saw it in a Trump rally. When, you know, somebody was slugged and they arrested the, or they took the person who was slugged out of the hall, you know. So
that's right. Yeah, and, no, that's a really good parallel. And, you know, and at the very least, if we can deliberately take that, we know that inequality is there. We know that wrongful enforcement of the law is there, right? So then how do we create a sociodrama that calls that to more people's attention?
Okay,
so
and we'll talk business. About how we do that in just a minute. We need to take a break. Mm-hmm. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio, and my guest is Larry Bodag. We're talking about tactical performance.
The heart of every man in our platoon must swell with pride for the nation's youth, the cream of which is marching at his side, for the fascinating rules and regulations that we share, and the quaint and curious costumes that we're called upon to wear. Now Al joined up to do his part, defending you and me. He wants to fight and bleed and kill and die for liberty. With the hell of war, he's come to grips, policing up the filter tips. It makes a fella proud to be a soldier. When Pete was only in the seventh grade, he stabbed a cop.
All right, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Tracy, a little political parody there, or
yeah,
satire?
Yeah, it's like a parody. Somebody recommended by our guest, the great Tom Lehrer. It's like indescribable. Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, our guest being Larry Bodag, who is a professor of political performance at the University of California at Davis, and where he teaches satire, irony, and protest, among other things. He's the author of Electoral Guerrilla Theater, Radical Ridicule and Social Movements, and of Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play. And he was co-founder of the Clandestine Insurgent Rebel Clown Army, which we were talking about a few minutes ago. Welcome back, Larry.
Thanks, Thorne.
Or LM, as you as your byline is.
That's right. I publish as L.M. Bodag. Don't ask me why. It's been that way for a while. But anyway, Larry Bodag works too.
Does it work? They both work?
Yeah,
okay.
Totally.
Well, I'm not. I will refrain from actually referring, you know, saying, well, tell me L.M.
I know. It is a little awkward.
But I understand the use of bylines. And sometimes I use my middle name, Thorne Web Dreyer, when I write something I think especially significant. I don't know.
Right, right.
Okay. This whole story is fascinating, and I, you know, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the things that you have actually done? You were St. Francis. You were St. Francis, and you were the angry banker. Tell about those kind of things that you put together and how that works as political theater.
Right. Thank you. No, I appreciate you mentioning it, Thorne. The range of this kind of work goes from like a really big media prank where we do something really outrageous and fun that gets on CNN and MSNBC because it's just so gripping. And I can mention some of those examples too later. But what the ones you're mentioning now are the more local grassroots kind of things that are just for one campaign or one, local action, which I think are equally important. You have to do stuff at the local immediate level too. So those are examples of using street theater on picket lines. Okay. And I'll get into it in a second, but just want to spend a minute on this. I think the picket line is this ideal place to use tactical performance. It often, be it for, let's say it's a labor strike at a small business or a big business, or it's a boycott for something because people are doing something unfair. Often the picket line, it's such a traditional thing and it's very important, but it's also become a place that can be very cliched. You know, we do the same things at picket lines. We march around in circles with the same signs and we chant the same chants. And of course we do that because that's the convention and I understand it. I'm not insulting it or anything. It's just that when we're doing this kind of work, like it or not, it is a performance. So we might as well think about it as a performance and make it the best performance possible. When you're just doing the same old thing, it's cliched just like any other art form. So if you write a bad poem and it's cliched, nobody likes your poem. If you go see a movie and within the first 5 minutes you know the ending because it's cliched, it's kind of a drag, isn't it? And the movie might not do that well. And I'm just saying that because protest is an art form too. So let's make the picket lines exciting. Let's make them surprising and interesting and compelling. Let's try to think of it in terms of charismatic action so it's not so easily ignored and people don't just avoid it. So again, so at the picket line in some of these examples that you mentioned there, there was a situation, a labor conflict at the St. Francis Hotel here in San Francisco years ago. And they had locked out the workers because they were trying to break the union. So they just kicked all the workers out, actually. And I was, working with the union, and I said, geez, they're called St. Francis. Whether or not people are into this, St. Francis was the patron saint of the poor,
So who better to intervene?
Exactly, Lauren, exactly. So I put out a press release saying, St. Francis descends from heaven, joins the workers in the picket line at the St. Francis Hotel. And there was a little interview with St. Francis about how he was upset they were using his name, when they were doing these terrible things to the workers. And so when the picket line actually started that day, there I was in a ridiculous St. Francis costume. The union people had been part of writing a script about it. We did an exorcism of the demons of greed from the hotel. Everybody was really into it. We were having fun with it. It was also a picket line, We were giving out pamphlets and informing people of what was happening. But people were more likely to hang out, listen, participate, because it was such a wacky thing. And the symbolism resonated, and it made sense. We even got a wonderful real Franciscan priest who's a longtime activist, Father Louis Vitali, who thought it was funny. God bless him. I mean, I was really impressed. Because there I am as his patron saint, that could be pretty tasteless, but he appreciated it. He said, yeah, no, I like it. And he was there, too, to be part of it and to give some speeches. So the St. Francis Hotel did later give in and gave the union a contract. I'm not going to say it's just because of this one action, but I think it's a fun part of an overall action. Maybe it's 5% of the total, in terms of its importance. I don't know. But there's a qualitative value to everybody showing up, being creative, so the people doing it are having fun and they're more likely to keep going in the struggle. And people walking by, or if it's covered on the media, it's more compelling and it's a more interesting story. Less easily ignored and perhaps more easily gets people to be sympathetic to you. So that's it. That's the St. Francis example. And they were getting into it, too, because there was the Hilton Hotel had locked out their workers, and some of the union guys were like, hey, why don't we have someone in drag as Paris Hilton go protest that one? I said, now we're talking, guys. Now you're getting creative.
Now you get the idea. That's
exactly.
The ticket.
you're catching on here. Because it's good to just not do the same old thing, and let's use surprise instead of cliche. I try to get into that in the book, too. The Angry Banker one was a little more recent, but it was a few years ago. I just had a number of people called me up locally They were protesting Wells Fargo's global headquarters in San Francisco for a lot of specific policy things that that bank was doing, you know, in terms of foreclosing mortgages, refusing small business loans, avoiding taxes, a whole bunch of things. So they gave me the information. Again, you got to work with the people who have the serious data. You know, that's their specialty. And they just said, look, we're blockading in a nonviolent way just to get some attention to the issue. Could you do some kind of street theater as part of this? So I, along those lines, I said, geez, well, what's missing from the picture when everybody sits down and just, you know, peacefully blocks the, you know, doors, probably get arrested and spend a couple hours in jail and get processed? You know, it's not a violent thing. I think it's a perfectly valid way to protest and make your point. But what's missing is we don't have the bankers telling their side of the story. I'll be the banker. So I just showed up as an angry banker. It's a YouTube video now. And I just wanted to ironically represent the people who were just mad at these protesters, because the real guys are too smart. They're not going to show up and make a whole scene. They'll just wait until the police remove the people and then go to work, right? They don't want to make a scene. So let's have a guy in a suit, me, show up and very ironically, in a silly way, show up as the voice of the bad guys and make a comedic, you know, not trying to fool anybody or anything. In fact, some of the media were attracted to what I was doing, and they asked me, how long have you worked for Wells Fargo? And I was like, 2 minutes, you know, just to make sure they get the idea that this is a joke, you know. And but it's fun to get people to work along with you, right, when you're being ironic, pretending to be the banker. Yeah, for the first 2 seconds, it's like, hey, wait a minute, is he really a banker? He seems to be mad at these protesters. But then what he's saying is actually kind of ironic. I get it. So when people get it after the first 3 seconds, it's actually a nice feeling. You watch their eyes light up, and they're like, whether they like it or not, they've done a little bit of creative work interpreting it. Irony can go wrong, and it misfires. Yeah, you got to watch out for that.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the two guys who consistently pranked Donald Trump rallies? I think Rachel Maddow did a feature on them, and nobody even realized it was these same two guys doing these different things until... until she caught on to it, or until finally someone...
Oh, that's really interesting. I don't think I know who that is. Can you tell us some more about that, actually?
Right now I can't remember the things they did, but they were pretty remarkable. People can check that out. And I will send you a link later. So
cool. That's great. I want to learn more, because that sounds amazing. The Trump rallies are an ideal place to do something unexpected. I will say that. I have not personally done it.
They're rife with irony.
Yeah, exactly. And because everyone's all amped up for some kind of violence, right? So why play into that? You know, that's just going to go bad real quickly, right? And it's predictable, and it makes people act in this automatic way. But if you can do something funny like that and ironic that kind of opens up people's minds, I think that would be the way to go. I don't happen to know about that example, but I like hearing about it.
Okay, tell me about this. And I know that you talk about an incredible example where I guess it was with the dead GIs being brought back from Iraq and the censorship of those images. And then you talk about the concept of performing the censored image.
Yeah, exactly. I'm so glad you brought that up, Thorne, because it's also an example of, it doesn't always have to be funny. Like a lot of what we do, you know, I participated in groups like the Clown Army that use humor, or Billionaires for Bush was a funny group that pretended to be a bunch of oligarchs for Bush, and what we did was trying to be ironic and funny. But here's an example from the other side of the emotional palette, and we need to draw, like theater people, on all different ranges of emotions, right? So this was a group called the Thousand Coffins, very serious but also very poignant and beautiful. And yeah, as you said, what had happened is the Bush administration had outlawed by executive order anyone from taking photographs of the flag coffin, the flag-covered coffins of the soldiers whose bodies were being returned from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And of course, some people were pursuing that in court, saying, hey, wait a minute, that's not constitutional. You know, and it's not invading their privacies because the names are not on the coffins. It's not like that. These are, there's no names. It is clearly, though, our fellow citizens being returned. And you can be totally pro the cause of the soldiers and their well-being without supporting a war policy, right? Those are two separate things, although conservatives like to conflate those, right? So it's like, we totally support the troops. We're against the war. It's different. And we want to record the coming home of the cost of the war, right? But so people were fighting it in court. That took years, And ultimately, President Obama just overturned it as unconstitutional himself because it was an executive order. So that's how that played out. But in the meantime, for years, it was not legal. And so what a group of activists chose to do, which I thought was very creative, you call the 1,000 coffins, they just created 1,000 coffins, covered them with flags, and marched them through the streets as part of these big demonstrations in New York and D.C. And they worked just to show their respect for the soldiers. You know, they worked with progressive veterans organizations to do it. You know, the point being, hey, this is very reverent. This is very respectful. We think that, that these people's loss should be recorded, and we should have a real conversation about if we support this policy, right? So we're not against the troops. We're just opposed to the president's policy, which in a democracy you should have the right to do. So the whole idea of marching those coffins through the streets and then on the mall in D.C. creating these installations of the coffins attracted, first of all, a tremendous amount of attention. It was that image got onto the front pages of many major newspapers, you know, because it's just a gripping and compelling image. It's an irresistible image, I think. And it, you know what it's about just by looking at it. You don't even need to read the article, you know. Yeah, it's, right. It communicates itself.
Right.
But
right.
I also do like to think of it, as you said, as performing the censored image. It's a way of outflanking censorship. You
okay.
know, you're not allowed to take a photograph right. of the real thing. Well, you are allowed to just create the image yourselves with the materials in hand and go ahead and do it and can make that contribution to democracy and democratic debate about a war policy, you know.
Okay.
So I thought that was an example of very serious, very somber, very respectful, and again, working with veterans who wanted to do it and who supported it. So there you are. You know, I think.
Okay, we have a news flash. In this day of instant electronic gratification, my man Tracy here has found the answer to our to
what?
The two the guys.
Oh, cool.
So Tracy Schultz.
Well, since Thorne mentioned it, I was able to find it pretty quick. There's a nice little article on Mediate talking about these guys, and yeah, they dressed up as brown shirts at a Trump rally, but it was done in to a comedic effect and something a little bit more maybe more humorous. At a Marco Rubio rally, they had signs that said they were protesting against Rubio because he kept stealing their girlfriends. And because he's a handsome guy, and but they also crossed different rallies at different places, and so it's like, but it's these two guys, it's like they're improvers, they've been in Seattle and other places, but it's a Devram Steffler and a Jason Selvig, and
wow.
They performed together as quote unquote guerrilla comedy, so kind of taking that idea to modern times.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's classic. Thank you, Tracy. I mean, this is great. But, and again, to bring that levity, even when it's very pointed, to a place that just gets violent all too easily and all too quickly, you know, which then ends up drowning out what the actual issues are you're trying to use. So I think that's great.
Yeah. Okay, we're talking with L.M. Larry Bogad, just to remind people, he's the master of serious, silly activism. Seriously silly activism.
So, I like that.
Yeah, that's
yeah. That's, you know, there's other examples, too, of that kind of infiltrating an event, but then not just shutting it down, but doing something creative. I like to think of it as, like, sometimes we try to occupy space with our protests. You know, you occupy a town square or a building. And I get that, and that's great, but it's great to also open that space up for creativity because we want to give a vision of the world that we want. It's great to, you know, you have to protest what you're against, but to think in terms of drama and also give a vision of the world you want to see too. Okay, we're against this part, but this is what our world would look like. So when you can create an occupation or a demonstration that is creative and fun and there's many different kinds of people represented, so it's diverse, you know what I mean? That expresses a joyful atmosphere, gives a sense of what you want, and maybe it's charismatic and more people want to get involved next time. And the people doing it have fun, so they're more likely to come back. So I think that kind of thing is really important. You can have a radical costume ball, you know, in the downtown, you know,
right.
And everyone show up dressed as their favorite oligarch, you know, their favorite billionaire who they want to make fun of. And all of a sudden you just have like 100 people or 1,000 people or even 7 people, who cares, people showing up being creative and checking each other's costumes out, being like, oh, this is great. It's like radical Halloween. And I think that's just a simple example, but a way to make it so that people can participate. Because it's great to go to a demo and just kind of listen to the speakers at the microphone and they're talking and you're just listening. But that is a very passive way to protest. And it's nice, I think, when you give people a framework in which everyone can do a little bit of expressing themselves and not just listening to the experts.
Yeah, we did a wonderful event here in Austin called Bring Out the Dogs. And it was a protest at Senator John Cornyn's office. And Senator John Cornyn at that time was known. George Bush had nicknames for everybody. And his nickname for John Cornyn was Corn Dog. And so we did this demonstration, and so we called him Bush's lap dog. And it was this wonderful event, and everybody came as dogs or brought their dogs. And, I mean, Scooby-Doo was there, and everybody, all your famous dogs. And I had a big furry dog suit. And we had incredibly creative signs, and someone was pulling along a doghouse that said "Office of Senator John Cornyn," and so it was a wonderful event. I mean, there weren't any speeches or anything.
No,
yeah.
You were talking amongst yourselves, and you were expressing yourselves, right?
That's right.
That's a great example.
You know, those both human and canine among us.
Human and canine. We're cross species protest. We're not discriminating against dogs. I think that's really progressive of you guys.
I think so too. We felt real good about it.
And that's something that folks can approach different ways. They can either take it as a straight, hard satire that it is, or it's like, hey, this is just a fun family event that just happens to have these underlying
meanings. Should have had a picnic.
Absolutely. If you can bring the whole family, now we're talking.
Okay, we need to take another break. I'm Thorin Dreyer. My guest is Larry Bugad, and we're having a whole lot of fun here.
All call up AT&T and protest to the president. March. Can't you see him smirking and smiling? 'Cause he's got us all digit dialing. So let's all call up AT&T and protest to the president. March. So protest, do your best. Let us show him that we march in unity. If he won't change the rules, let's take our business to another phone company.
Okay, and that was Alan Sherman, right?
Yeah, that was recommended by Molly here at
Molly Chesney here in the station.
Yeah,
recommended that one.
So, it's called Let's All Call Up AT&T and Protest to the President March. Since we have 4th of July just right around the corner, very John Philip Sousa.
Okay, and our guest is not terribly John Philip Sousa, L.M. Larry Bugad. And who is an author, performer, educator, and the founding director of the Center for Tactical Performance. So, and among many things, he founded the Clown Army, which is certainly a remarkable achievement, which, if nothing else, will get you, Larry, into the all-time Hall of Fame.
Excellent.
The Clown Hall of Fame, anyway. So.
I used to like to say in my bio that I was a veteran of the Lincoln Center Theater Director's Laboratory, which is this highfalutin theater thing in New York, just to make it like I have a little bit of cred, and then throw in the Clown Army in the same sentence, just to contrast the two, the two wings of my so-called career here.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'd like to talk a little bit, for you to talk a little bit about historical instances of this kind of theater, because I think it ranges from the Yippies to Dada, and Pegasus for President, the Yippies throwing the money onto the floor of the stock exchange, these things that were, there's some pretty remarkable political theater, and it seems like one of the things about it is that the image that it's a simple image or concept that gets across a much more complex story.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
so. Absolutely. And sometimes, you know, in the case of the Dadaists or the Yippies, it was even a rejection of conventional logic. Like, it had its own internal logic, what they were doing, but they were deliberately, you know, they were countercultural. So they were even trying to do something very different from, like, what we discussed, the civil rights movement was very much trying to work with the culture, like get sympathy from regular folks right. in a way that everyone can understand. You know, it was very straightforward in that sense, you know, the sit-ins and such. Now, the Yippies are doing something different. They're of this youth culture, this counterculture, and they're actually trying to blow people's minds, you know.
It was very, very seditious.
Yeah, very seditious, exactly. And so at that basic level, they're not trying to do something that looks similar. And by the way, a number of the Yippies, it's interesting, actually worked with the civil rights movement when they had just been a few years younger. So as young guys, they had gone down and in some cases gotten beaten up in the deep South working as serious civil rights activists, okay? Then they went back up north, and they're mostly white guys up there and women, and having had that very serious experience, but having learned, I think, about sociodrama, then they got turned on and became part of the counterculture, but still had that experience under their belts, if you see what I mean. Like, they saw it's still important, even if you're using a different language, like being a freaky guy, you know, running a pig for president, or levitating the Pentagon, as they claimed they had done, you know, surrounding the right. Pentagon and meditating with Allen Ginsberg, chanting Om, and they claimed they made the Pentagon levitate and change colors.
Of course, then after that, we all just charged through the barriers and surrounded the thing. I was there. And
you were there.
Yeah,
oh
I was
God.
There. And when we talked about the clowns, you know, there were young women putting flowers in the guns of the National Guardsmen there and so forth. So there was some of that same kind of that sort of soft confrontation.
For sure. I mean, that's amazing that you were there. And in fact, frankly, Thorne, the clown kissing the shield really is sort of an international echo of that flower in the gun moment. You know, it's like almost a citation of it with a little different twist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that's amazing. I would say that they're definitely the Yippies are influenced by things like the civil rights movement and then trying to do something a little different in terms of creating a new counterculture. So it has a different vocabulary, right? It's very irreverent and very outrageous, but deliberately and knowingly so. And thinking in terms of working with the new media, Abbie Hoffman wrote a lot of interesting books about, and a lot of it was about using television, this mass popular medium, and thinking strategically about how to communicate through the television screen in a new way. So all these strange actions were about reaching through, not really communicating in a conventional way through the TV folks doing straight interviews, but creating bizarre images that communicated what you want. When they dropped the money on the stock exchange people, right? And all the stock exchange traders kind of freaked out and started grabbing the money.
They were crawling around on the floor grabbing it.
You know what I mean? So they created that image, which was just a heightened image of what was already happening on that floor anyway.
Right.
Of people running around trying to grab money, but doing it through trading. And now you drop money and people go crazy. It's just like making it a little more literal. And I don't know if they knew that was going to happen, honestly. I think they were just experimenting and they wanted to see what would happen. But what happened was pretty outrageous and I think probably worked better than they thought it would. So, you know, by the way, I do talk in the other book, Electoral Guerrilla Theater, about a group in the Netherlands that were ideological, like friends and cousins of the Yippies. They were called the Kabouters, or the gnomes. In Dutch, it means gnomes. So these are eco-anarchist gnomes around the same time as the Yippies. In fact, I saw when I went over there for research an international treaty signed by the Yippies and the Kabouters. They signed a treaty of friendship between, you know, wacky countercultural groups. And the gnomes, and I should say that at the time, late 60s, gnomes were still a very popular folklore character in Dutch culture, and everyone liked it. Was a cute little series of kid stories that everybody knew. So when a bunch of eco-anarchists who are very freaky and alternative start to refer to themselves as gnomes and dress as gnomes, it was actually a very charming thing to do, because at the same time they're squatting abandoned buildings, they're doing all kinds of activism around housing and in the environment and everything. So they're not just being funny, they're doing real activism. But they're also pretending that they're gnomes from another world, the magical world, that's basically after capitalism and environmental pollution have been done away with. Well, they ran for office, and in 1970, they won 5 seats in the Amsterdam City Council.
Right.
Which blew their minds as much as everyone else's.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's a whole chapter in that in that other book of mine where it's like, well, then what happened, and how did they handle it?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, the provost established some of that kind of stuff there. But yeah, I mean, what are some of the other instances of people who pranked their way into office?
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed researching that book because I got to meet these people who ran for office as a radical prank and ask them why they did it. You know, it was clearly not just fun and games. They had an issue they wanted to call attention to. And generally speaking, they knew they were not going to win, you know. But it wasn't about winning. It was about using all the media attention that elections get for their cause or their critique they were making. So one of my favorite examples was from Australia, and this is one of the chapters in the book. There was a woman in Parliament named Pauline Hanson. Let me know if she sounds familiar. I'm going to describe her. She had quite shocking color of hair, first of all. That's the least important thing about her. And she was really against foreign immigration and also had a real problem with the Aboriginal folks in Australia. So she had a lot of racially controversial positions, but there was quite a lot of white backlash at the time in the mid-90s in Australia, and she got elected into Parliament. So I don't know if she sounds like somebody right now, but just throwing that out there.
I get you. I follow your drift.
I'm very subtle, I know. So she was in Parliament and really causing a lot of controversy and doing that quite well, I should say, unfortunately. So here comes a guy who is one of the artists I talk about, Simon Hunt. He says, Pauline Hanson. He changes his name legally to Pauline Pantsdown. He gets on the ballot so he can run for office with the name Pauline Pantsdown. And he proceeds to dress just like her, have makeup just like her, and go on tour. Most importantly, he digitizes her voice from the radio and from TV and makes 2 hit dance songs using her voice, but he changes the words around so they're like against her politics and for, you know, diversity and such.
Wow.
And kind of making fun of her xenophobia. So those songs were really popular, and it was a way for people, they became his campaign songs as Pauline Pantsdown, and more importantly, they just embarrassed her. And she sued for one of the songs, which was a bad idea because then it got much more attention. It just went crazy. And, of course, he only got a few thousand votes. He wasn't trying to win. He was trying to sabotage her politics and her racism. And she lost her bid for re-election, at least partly because of him.
Split,
I don't know.
He split, you
know,
the vote. He split the Pauline vote.
He split the Pauline vote. That's hilarious. Exactly.
Well, you know, did he campaign sans britches?
Indeed. Well, in a nice skirt.
that's good. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. Gotcha. Gotcha.
There was one guy that I remember seeing here in Austin. He came through as part of a speaking tour to talk about him and his life as mayor of Reykjavik, Iceland, is John Gunnar.
Oh, Jan Gnar, totally. He's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Again, another guy, comedian, actor. He ran on the promises of free towels for everybody at the swimming pool and a polar bear for the local zoo. And he won. And
it was amazing.
He called his party the best party because why wouldn't he?
I mean, what a great
who's
going to
vote
idea.
For the We're worst
the
party?
Vote for the best. Oh, okay. I mean, he was really, and that's an example, as you just said, of someone who actually won. Like, he became the mayor, and then he got most of his guys, like, they took over the city council too. So they had the mayorship and the majority of the city council. You know, so it's this just happened recently, right?
Yeah.
They just finished their term a little while ago.
Yeah, he did his 4-year term and finished his office in 2014, but he's still active. He's still politically active.
Tell us a little bit.
I'm glad you mentioned. That's a great example.
We're down to just about 5 minutes. Briefly tell us, and then I want to talk to you about some. Well, no, let's not even do that because we've got such a short amount of time. How about this? How did you get corrupted? I mean, did you start out like planning to be, you know, an actor or you start, you know, straight ahead theater, you know, nerd and, you know, what happened to you?
Man, that is a great question. I sit around and wonder that every day. What the heck happened to me?
What went wrong?
I know. When I was about 16, I first auditioned for a play, you know. And I absolutely love the theater. I mean, I love the expression and the creativity as a young guy, but I also love the teamwork aspect. It was one of those things. It was a social, the idea that we all work together at this social art, I think, really excited me about it. And I was just starting to be, as a kid, a little bit of an activist too, especially then going on to college. So that's where the corruption began, Thorne, because I started to see, even as a 18, 20-year-old, whatever, I was like, okay, our protests are okay. I'm glad to be part of it. But we're not very original. You know, like, I don't think we're a little easily ignored because we're not doing the stuff that I'm learning you're supposed to do in the theater, you know, which is to be surprising, you know, which is to be compelling. And so just even at that point, I started to try to think about how do I fuse these two interests, you know, the social justice side and the dramatic side. And so I think it just kind of slowly developed from there. And always looking for people to collaborate with, you know, I've had the good fortune to work with big spectacular groups like the Yes Men, and we made fake newspapers like a fake New York Times that we distributed, a fake New York Post that had the news we wanted to see in the world. So that was disruptive and wacky and definitely got a lot of global attention. But then just doing it on the local level, like I mentioned, I think it's important just for an everyday protest to make it more interesting.
Okay, and all the news that fits, we print.
Exactly. Ours actually said all the news we hope to print.
Oh, okay.
Because it was like the news we wanted in the world, but that was snuck into that little box there, yeah.
Okay, there's something interesting that I saw. Activist George Lakey coined the term demonstration dilemma to describe a public action that puts authorities in a situation in which they have no good move to make.
Yeah. So important. Such an important idea. And when you do it with using dramatic skills, I think it's even better. The basic idea is, okay, you have an opponent, you know, the state or a big corporation, and they're doing something very oppressive. What if you create a protest where if they crush you, you've set it up so that it's very politically costly for them? You know, like it's more politically costly to club a clown than to just club a regular protester. I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's right, but it happens to be true, you know?
Yeah.
If you set things up so that they look ridiculous if they attack you, I think that helps. And if they don't, but then you also set it up, this is what makes it a dilemma. If they do try to crush you, it looks it's politically costly to them. But you're also doing something that's transgressive enough that if they don't respond, it calls attention to the bad thing they're doing, if you see
right.
what I mean.
Right.
I think the sit-ins are a great example. You know, it really cost those oppressors a lot when they crushed the people just trying to sit down. But if they hadn't done it, then you're allowing these people to break this racist law. We can't have that. It starts to undermine the whole idea, you know? And it exposes the fact that if you leave them alone and just let them eat at the counter, nothing bad happens. It's fine. Leave these people alone. You know, so if they do, it hurts them. And if they don't, it hurts their cause.
Well, you know, it was,
so Gandhi was a master of setting up these kinds of actions.
Well, it seems like that the Democrats in the House of Representatives created something of the same kind of situation recently with their sit-in.
That's right. And amazing.
The Republicans didn't know what to do. They had no way to deal with it. They couldn't drag John Lewis out of the chamber.
You know? No, and here's John Lewis, who we've all seen probably the pictures of him covered in his own blood when he did these dangerous protests as a young man in the civil rights movement, right? Yeah. And being attacked and really risking his life. And here he is taking this stand on the floor of the Congress. It's very moving to see that. You know, to see that. And so he knew what he was doing, that's for sure.
Okay, we have a little more than a minute. Tell us what else you're working on.
Well, right now in the world of theater or performance art, I have kind of a ridiculous piece called Econo Music. And in Econo Music, I convert economic data into music, like as the unemployment rate goes up and down, the music goes up and down, if you know what I mean. And so it's an audience participatory kind of avant-garde concert that I do, where you get to feel the data because you're humming it or singing it. I'm playing, you know, the incarceration rate on my flute, and the audience is singing along with the, you know, the income of the upper 1%. And it's very ridiculous and Dadaist, but you also, it's a way to get audience to learn these crazy data information. If I just told you it, it would not be interesting. It would be boring. So I'm doing this performance in Buenos Aires, actually, and Santiago, Chile, in July. And so I'm going to travel a little bit, but I've done this piece in Helsinki. I did it on a squatted military base in Barcelona, an abandoned military base, and also just in, like, museums and art galleries and theaters. So the latest thing is Econo Music. I'm trying to have some fun with that. It, again, a way to explain or experience data in a more interesting way. and social problems.
Okay. All right. This has been great. We will do this again.
I hope so, Thorin. This was a blast, and thank you so much, Tracy.
It's been a lot of
fun. I really appreciate it.
Larry Bogad, whose books are Electoral Guerrilla Theater, Radical Ridicule and Social Movements, and Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play. And I think we've learned a whole lot. All right. next week, the wonderful jazz singer and songwriter Sarah Sharp will be with us here in discussion and performance. And we truly look forward to that. You will be able to find the podcast of this show that you just listened to, plus all the other shows we've done, at go to theragblog.com/ragradio. Thank you for being with us. I'm Thorin Dreyer. Thank you, Tracy Schultz. And we'll be back next week.